Okay, so we have a lot to do today. I want to talk a little bit about the second Aliyah of Truma and also a little bit about Parsha Zachar if we can squeeze everything in. And every year, this time of year, give a little bit of a general note about these Parshios, that when we start the section of the Torah, essentially the second half of Shmos, and the first half of Vayikra, so we encounter many psukim that describe things that we don't really do nowadays, that talk about either the construction of the Beis HaMikdash and the Mishkan in this case, and the Kalim, as is the topic of the second half of Shmos, or the details of the Korbanos, that is the theme of the first half, the first part of Vayikra. And on the one hand, it's harder for us to really relate to the content of the psukim because it's not something that we practice in our daily lives. It's not narrative either, so it's not a story, nor is it a discussion of mitzvahs we're familiar with. And there's a lot of detail, a lot of detail in these parashios, which may make it feel like it's much harder to relate to than other parts of the Torah that are one or the other, either a story or something that we connect to as far as our daily mitzvah performance. But the truth is, there is a major reason why it's all the more important and also rewarding for us to pay attention to these psukim carefully, especially because we're not able to perform them nowadays. We know that when it comes to the korbanos, at least, there is a notion of neshama parim sfoseinu, that in the time when we're not able to bring the korbanos, so we connect to that experience through learning about it. And the Gemara says, the Mishnah says, the end of Menachos, the Gemara expands on the idea that by learning about these things, it's credited to us as if we're actually doing them. So from that perspective, it's even more important to be learning about these topics, because that's the only connection that we have to these values. But also, it's particularly an added element when considering the Mishkan and the Kalim and the Korbanos, that they are filled with symbolism and that we are supposed to see something in all of the details. And particularly in this door, where the details are theoretical for us, they don't necessarily translate into what we are doing at the moment, but all the more so, that points us to focus on what we can learn from the symbolism and the details and what values are represented. And as that is the case, there's so much drush about these parashios and much more than you might think. So we'll just try to highlight a few of the themes that come out of these parashios in this week's parasha and Parshas Truma. And we'll hope to get a little bit out of it in the time that we have before also talking about Parsha Zachar. But I should give you as a mar makom, and I probably should have mentioned this before Seder this morning, but you should know in general, that in particular for these topics where we have these psukim that are filled with different symbolic imagery, Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch has a tremendous amount to say in his commentary on the Chumash. And including very much this Aliyah, second Aliyah of Truma, has pages upon pages and pages with pictures. It's very illuminating, and we won't be able to come close to doing justice to what he has to say. But if you have time, if you have a copy of the Sefer, if you have access to the Sefer over Shabbos, I would recommend pondering what he has to say there, and it will be true throughout these parashios, but it happens to be very, very much the case about this Aliyah that we're talking about today. It has just a tremendous amount of discussion of the symbolism in this Aliyah and a lot to add to what we can offer. So just to jump in, so this Aliyah talks about some of the Kalim, some of that which is inside the Beis HaMikdash, or again in this case the Mishkan. We'll use the terms Mishkan and Beis HaMikdash interchangeably for now. It's also one of the themes of the Parsha, that Parsha starts off, Yasuli Mikdash V'Shachanti V'Socham, and the references at that point to the Mishkan that they had in the Midbar, but ultimately it would be relevant to the Bate Mikdash, And as the Mechas Tinuch explains, all one mitzvah, all one commandment, every heichal that we had for the avodah is all included in this mitzvah of Yasuli Mikdash v'shachanti b'socham. And according to the Rambam, the kelim that we read about here are also included in that same mitzvah. Everything that's constructed is all part of one mitzvah. The Ramban disagrees, and the Ramban understands that the kelim are a separate mitzvah. And why that is a lot to discuss. Could be, as some suggest, that the Rambam understands that the Mishkan is there primarily for the Avodah Sakarbanos. So everything that makes that possible is all included in one directive. While the Ramban, in separating them, the Ramban is understanding that the purpose of the Mishkan is not necessarily for the Karbanos, it has a purpose in and of itself. And that's consistent with what he says in his commentary to Chumash in the Sutz Parsha, that the purpose of the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash is to have a home for the Shechina. So that's its own mitzvah. And the Kelim, which then make everything possible that happens inside there, it's a separate mitzvah. But one way or another, it's either its own mitzvah or part of a larger mitzvah. So our Parsha talks about both. And we'll come back to that point in a few moments. But first the Parsha of the Aliyah begins, V'nasata el Aaron, Esa Idus, Asher Tene Lecha, so that's at the end of the previous Aliyah, Sarga Sisa Kapora, Sahav Dor, I'm assigned the Chetzi Arkav, Yamav Chetzi Rechba. So you should make a Kaporas for the Aaron. And the Kaporas, as the Rishonim explain, is the Lashon Kisui. It is a cover that goes on top of the Aaron. Therefore, it has the length corresponds to that. And it's made out of Zav Tahar. It's made out of gold completely. And as Bechor Shor points out, because this is meant to testify to the Shechina, to represent to the Shechina, so therefore, the whole thing is gold. It's not just a gold covering, but it's gold through and through. And that's a part of what the Torah is conveying here. So the Yerushalmi, in the very beginning of Shkolim, the Yerushalmi says that a part of the message of it being gold, an additional theme here, is that this is to be mechaper on the Egel Hazav. So the gold of the Aron and the Kaporos should come and be mechaper for the Egel Hazav. So that may raise the question, as the Torah Tamima notes, and as the Gemara already addresses, that we know that we're not supposed to wear gold on Yom Kippur, and the Kohen Gadol didn't wear gold, all because of the principle of Ein Kategor, Nasa Sanegor. That if we're trying to advocate for ourselves, if we want to have a Sanegor, we want to have that which will come and defend us and advocate for us, so then we can't use that which is a Kategor. We can't use that which brings up our guilt. So here the Egel Hazav is a bad part of our history, so we want to move away from that imagery. So normally we have this aversion to gold. So the Torah Tamima brings this up, and the Gemara already brings this up over there in Rosh Hashanah, Daf Chavav and Aleph, where we have this discussion a little bit. And the suggestion there is Chayte Bal Yaakov Kamrinan, Bal Yaakov Kamrinan, meaning that the one who should not bring this forward is the Chote himself, that the idea of the human being is the one who sins, so he shouldn't be dressed in gold. But it doesn't mean that gold has no place. My grandfather points out in his commentary there, well, it's not technically only about clothing, because we find this also by the shofar. And he also notes that there's another explanation about the clothing, and going in a side direction, that the clothing is an issue of gaiva, that we should come in that context looking too haughty. But as far as the shofar and the clothing as opposed to the aron, it seems that the distinction is that when we are coming to represent ourselves or to advocate for ourselves, which the Gemara says about the shofar, is also the imagery. So to use a tool that is going to bring up the imagery of Egel Azav, so that's not a great idea. That's not something that we would want to place front and center. But here, this is what's supposed to represent to us, really, the Torah, the Luchos. So therefore, for that to be gold, and for that to take the place of the gold of the Egel Hazav, and that the gold that was used for that terrible Aveira should instead redeem itself and honor the Torah, so then perhaps that's coming from a different direction. And maybe that's something we can understand a little more. The Gemara in Masechet Sukkah on Daat Hey tells us that the Kaporis was a Tefach Sik, even though the Chumash doesn't say that. And Rashi points this out, that we know this from the Gemara, but not from the Chumash. The Chizkuni says that because the thickness wasn't something that could be seen, so it's not mentioned. Other Rishonim talk about exactly where the Tefach was it across the knot. But the Ragachaver just highlights in this Sefer and Chumash that the point is that it was a Kli, the Kaporis was a Kli in and of itself. And in fact, when the Gemara tells us that it was a Tefach, the Gemara learns it out from the comparison to other Kalim to make the point that it is its own Kli, which is itself something that has its own significance that we'll come back to. So the next pasuk tells us about the kruvim, v'yasisa shnayim kruvim zav, miksha ta'aseh osam, mishnei k'tzos ha-kaporas, that we should make these two cherubim, as they say in English, the two kruvim, and the idea that they are fashioned to look like children, there's a discussion of the Rishonim, some other possibilities as well, but that's what it sounds like from the Gemara, also over there in Masechet Sukkah and Pe'imar Aleph in there. The Gemara understands that the language of Kruvim is Kir Ravya, like a Ravya. Ravya is a child. The Kruvim look like children. And Rashi emphasizes that the language, the Pasuk of Miksha Achas, it's all one piece, that this has to be, this all has to be done as a part of one unit, that it's not that you make the kaporis and then you have a piece of gold that you add on top of it afterwards, but it all has to be one piece of gold that you formulate in this way. And various symbolisms that are associated with that, the Lahoris Nasir of Nassim Gestetner suggested that it means that the chinuch of children has to be specifically from within Torah, so it comes from the same gold of the kaporis, it's all one part. Rav Moshe David Steinwerk, who was the Baba Verosh Kol, they just printed an edition of his Chidushim on Chumash, so he understands that the imagery is based on a medrash. There's the medrash that says that when God offered the Jewish people the Torah, they said they want it, and God says, well, I need an arev, I need a guarantor that you're going to uphold it. So they responded, our children will be the guarantors. So if that's the idea, the whole notion that we will raise children who will follow in this path, and that will justify our receiving the Torah in the first place, so perhaps that's the idea that the Kruvim are supposed to represent as children that are holding on to the Torah, that are a part of the structure of the Kaporas. And the Sefer Ber Yosef, he has a whole drasha about this, where he talks about various points. He notes that in the Beis HaMikdash of Shlomo, so he added two bigger Kruvim that went were standing on the ground. There's the two on the Aron and two bigger ones that were standing on the ground. And he has a whole drasha about how there's different relationships that we have to Torah when we're able to focus completely on Torah and when we have to be out there in the world making a living. So in the Midbar, so the Jews were being sustained completely by God. They didn't have any responsibility to do anything else. So there you just have the Kruvim on the Aron that are holding firm to the Torah and aren't anywhere else. But when the time of Shlomo, when people also had to be tending their farms and making a living, so there were also Kruvim that were standing at some distance apart, but they're all getting their yunika from the Kruvim that are still holding on to the Aron, and that has to be a part of the imagery as well. And he has a whole drush explaining how this fits in to other themes. But okay, so then the pasuk goes on to talk about how you make the kruvim, and pasuk chaf it says v'hayu hakruvim porsech nafayim l'mayla sochim v'chanfayim al kaporis ufneihim ishal achiv el kaporis yupnei hakruvim. So they spread their wings upward, and they cover it up with their wings, and their faces are towards each other, and also towards the cover. So here is, of course, a lot of imagery also, the idea of having them face each other and also having their hands on the Aron as they were doing that. So in the Tshuvas Chasam Sofer, he has a comment that Rav Nosson Gestetner in his Sefer Lahoros Nosson builds on the Chasam Sofer and his Tshuvas talks about the pasuk in last week's parsha, Lo Sana Al Riv Lintos in Parshas Mishpatim, that the idea he understands that pasuk to mean, well, you shouldn't respond to a quarrel to tilt it. Meaning what? That when you're involved in a machlokas about Torah, so your goal should be that you want to try to come to the truth. And it could be that the guy you're talking to, it could be that he's right. So you want to be open to that as well. And your mindset shouldn't be that you're trying to tilt it, that you're trying to convince him that you're right. Your goal should be that you're trying to find the truth. And it's one of the 7 habits of highly effective people. If you ever read that, it's a highly recommended book. So he talks there about one of the crucial habits is seek first to understand and then be understood. If you want to have a productive conversation, so you have to first try to make sure you understand correctly what the other guy is saying, and then try to get him to understand what you're saying. So that's in the spirit of what the Chasam Sofer is saying here, that that's what that pasuk means, that we are trying to get to the truth. We're not focusing first on trying to convince the other guy. We're trying to understand what the other guy has to say. So Laharis Nathan suggests, based on that here the imagery is, that here you have these chavrusas, so to speak. You have these 2 Talmidim, and they are interacting with each other, but their hands are on the Torah. Their hands are on the Arum. They're protecting the Torah because that's ultimately their goal. And the Shla also understands that there is an imagery of a Rav and Talmud here, and mutual respect between the Rav and the Talmud. Others understand it more as Talmidim. A friend, Rabbi Simon Shlita, in a sefer from Meibarach, has a whole drasha about those points. And this imagery of mutual respect between the Talmidim is a major, major theme and a crucial theme. And the Rashi of Karen B'Avna, as Goldwicht, commented that this is the idea the Mishnah has in Pirkei Avos, and it's actually an idea that's going to connect to Parsha Zachar, so hopefully we'll synergize with it at the end. We'll come back to this point. But the Rashi understood that Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, which tells us in the name of Rav Hanani ben Trajon, that Shnayim Shiyoshvu Bein Beneihem Divrei Torah, it's considered to be a Moshe of Leitzim. But if there is Divrei Torah between them, so then the Shechina is there, and the Mishnah quotes the Pasuk, Az Nidbaru Yirei Hashem. So the Rashiv explained that it doesn't mean that they're not learning. It says it means that you have 2 who are sitting and learning, Vein Bineihem Divrei Torah, that the Divrei Torah is not between them. There's just a sense of competition or a sense of isolation, perhaps, but the Divrei Torah are not connecting them, so that's a Moshe of Leitzin. So when the Mishnah calls it a Moshe of Leitzin, so what does Leitz mean? So, as we will discuss, God willing, it means that people are scoffers, that they are cynical, that they don't appreciate each other. And if that's the point, so if that's the attitude when you have these 2 people learning in the same space, but there's no Divrei Torah connecting them, no Divrei Torah between them, so then that creates an atmosphere of Moshe Leitzin. But if they listen to each other, as the pasuk suggests, about Nidbaru, they talk to each other, there's a conversation between them, so then that's where the Shechina is able to make its presence, and that's also a major part of the message here. The Gemara comments in Bava Basra and of Taritat, that the idea of Ufnehem Yishal Achiv, that they're looking at each other. So the Gemara says that this was a changing simon, that when the Jews were doing the will of God, so then they were facing each other. And when not, that's when they faced the bias. And the Laharis Nassim comments about that also, that doing the Ratzon Hashem unifies us, brings us all together. And that's also a part of that imagery. So then the pasuk goes on. In pasuk Chavalef, tells us in Asata Esa Kaporas Al Haron Milamaila, the El Haron Titain Esa Idus Asher Etain Aleh. So you should put the cover on top of the Aron, and you have inside the Aron, you have the Idus. So the order there, that it's also it's repeated, point that Rashi calls attention to. So why is it repeated? The Meshech Chachma comments that this is Shino Levakos of La'akev, that is here to emphasize to us that the our own has to have the luchos in it. That's a crucial part. And that's why there was no Aron in the Bayis Sheni, because it didn't have the luchos to be in it. And that interrelationship is perhaps what suggested how the Ramban emphasizes also. And Rashi here tells us that we shouldn't put the kaporet on before the Aron is inside. And the Rashi writes that even just to test it out, you shouldn't do that. So some understand this is to emphasize that it's a kli only, the art is a kli only for the luchos specifically. It doesn't have a meaning without it. That's itself a whole discussion. There is also a long drush about this in the Sefer Sheish Mashdar that we've mentioned a few times in the recent weeks. Very fascinating Sefer. So he puts this in the context of a larger theme in the Parsha. The whole Sefer is about themes in the individual Parshios. So there, to adapt a little bit, he says, not exactly how he says it, but to kind of jump off from what he says. So the Gemara in Maseches Brachos on Daf Nun Hey tells us that there was a difference of opinion between Moshe and Bezalel about the construction of the Mishkan and the Kelim, that Moshe told Bezalel to make the Kelim and then to make the Aron. And Bezalel said, really, shouldn't it be the other way around? Don't you first have to, first then to make the Mishkan, sorry, make the Kelim and then to make the Mishkan? And Bezalel said to him, isn't it the other way around? Don't you first make a house and then put Kelim inside of it? So why would you make the Kelim first? You should make the Mishkan and then put the Kelim in. Presumably that's what the Kodesh Baruch Hu said. And Moshe said, oh, you're right, Bezalel Kel, your name is Bezalel because you are in the shade of God. So there's a lot to figure out about that whole story. And it's one of the topics that he discusses in that essay. But he notes, and the Pesukim are not really clear, and he suggests that, what it sounds like, so some of the Rishonim understand that it was instructed one way before the Chet HaEgel, and then the actual construction was after the Chet HaEgel, and that's where Bezalel's version prevails. And essentially what he says, again, I'm adapting it a little bit, is that in a perfect world, before the Chet, before there was this inability to really grasp God that the Chet HaEgel revealed, so you could work on every component and maximize what every component means. But Klal Yisrael kind of slipped from that madrega, so they need more of a big picture kind of direction, like the Gemara says at the end of Makos, that later Nevi'im and Talmidei Chachamim kept boiling the Torah down to fewer and fewer principles, because people on a lesser madrega, they needed to have a summary version, fewer bullet points, just what the whole message is. So after the Chet, it made sense to have the Mishkan be the focus, not the Kelim be the focus. But in an ideal, perfect world, every detail is really where you start from, and you would be able to focus on the Kelim and then see a home for all these Kelim. So ultimately, Bezalel prevails, because after the Chet, that's what you need. But still, the ideal is the Torah first and then the Kli on top of it. So the idea of not to put the kaparis on until the luchos were in there, that represents that continued ideal symbol, which was how Moshe understood things were supposed to be to begin with. Okay, so the pesuk can continue. V'na'atu chasham, v'dibarti tcha me'al ha-kaparis, v'ben shnei akruv, mashal ha-na'idus, v'ischo sher tavo, tcha v'nei yisra, so I will communicate with you from there, v'yathis l'shulchan atei shitim, so now that you have the instruction of the Shulchan, and the Ramban explains that the Shulchan represents sustenance, as it does both in and out of the Mishkan, and that represents wealth, which we need, because if we want to have a bracha for that, we need wealth, we need sustenance to be able to survive. And you need to have a little bit in order for a bracha to have something to be challah. And that's an idea that we find throughout, that ain't a bracha sharura al kli rekam. You need to have a little bit of something for a bracha to be challah. And we find that with Elisha and the jugs of oil. And halacha, we find why we're not supposed to sweep off the table until after benching, because when we ask God for a bracha, we want to have some crumbs still on the table to represent the future. So the Shulchan has that imagery, but it's also interesting that it's here before the menorah. So the menorah represents Torah. So we have the Shulchan representing Mizonos before the menorah that represents Torah. So the Lev Avram, Avram Weinfeld, in his drush that we printed a little while ago, so he notes that that is because the Mishnah does tell us that the main kemach in Torah, that we're not going to be able to attain any spiritual heights unless we first are able to survive physically. So we need the basic sustenance so that we can go from there to spiritual growth. But that's just a basic necessity to be able to come from. But he also quotes the Tosfos Yontif that it is a cycle, that the main kemach in Torah, but if you're not going, once you have the basic sustenance, if you're not going to hold on to the Torah, so then you're not going to continue to survive. You're not going to be able to have that continued sustenance. So really, it's both. The main kemach in Torah, the main Torah in kemach. When President Berman began, and here's at Yeshiva University, so he emphasized this point that we say main kemach in Torah, but also main Torah in kemach, that nobody's going to want to support us if we're not representing very high-level Torah. So therefore, we have to appreciate the circular nature. So that's true, but in order to get started, so we need the kemach so that we can survive long enough in order to learn. So the Shulchan is there before the menorah and makes that point. Okay, so continue on a little bit. Okay, so maybe we'll skip a little bit. So we have to make poles out of shittim wood and cover them with gold, and we use that to carry the shulchan. The Meshech Chachma points out that it was lifted up during the Yom Tovim when the Oli Regalim were there to show God's love, and that's why actually the mission at the very end of the Chagiga, if you ever make a siyum on Shas, Mishnayos, or we make a siyum on Mishnayos Moed, so you have to explain this Mishnah, says that that's why they were subject to Tumah, theoretically, because they were moved around. Okay, so let's skip on a little bit. So v'nasate ala shulchan lechem panim, lefanai tamid, this is pasuk lamed. You should put the lechem panim on the table. And here the Lechem HaPanim, so as the Targum Yonason and others point out, that the 12 loaves, they represent the 12 Shvatim, and the Ber HaGola, the Maral comments that in the Beis HaMikdash you needed to have this, because the Mikdash is what is a unifying force, it brings together all the Shvatim, right? That's a part of the idea that a lack of Achdus is what leads to Golos and Chorban. Korban first and Golos, because the very nature of the Beis HaMikdash is to be a unifying place, and if we're not unified, so then we're not right to have a Beis HaMikdash. And Rav Yosef Engel points out in his Rashis in the Otzus Yosef that Shabbos is especially a unifying time, so therefore we have this arranged on Shabbos. That's a part of the message. Okay. And then we read about the menorah, the Askisa menorah, Zav Tar, Miksha Tahasa menorah, Yerecha, the Kanag, Via, Kaftareh, Farachah, Bimeni, Yiyu. So we should make a menorah also out of pure gold, and the menorah and the base and also the shaft should be hammered out of one piece, and the cups and the Kaftareh, Farachah, the knobs, and also the flower parts all should be made all from one piece. So here, so talking about this language of Teaseha, that you should miksha Teaseha, it shall be made. So Rashi comments that it was made on its own because Moshe Rabbeinu had a hard time. He wasn't able to relate to what exactly the instruction was. The Medrash Tanchuma actually says that in between, Kadosh Baruch Hu drew a picture of it on Moshe's hand to help him to understand. And this idea that God had to kind of make it because Moshe couldn't follow the instruction, so the Laharis Nassim, Nassim Gishetner, suggests that because the menorah represents the bris between God and the Jewish people. So Moshe thought that it needed to come from God because the bris needs to have from both sides. And the Bitalo Zdinsky and the Sefer Mishkan Bitalo, so he suggests that since the menorah represents Torah, so therefore we need to have this nes, so to speak, in order to convey to us that Hashem will help us and that we take the initiative to learn, but ultimately there is a siyata d'shmaya that comes from it, and that's where we're able to grow from. The Laharis Nassan also quotes from the Chacham Sofer, building on this idea that we mentioned before, that the Shulchan is before the menorah. He quotes the idea that the Machzikei HaTorah, those who support the Torah, they come first because they make the Torah possible. Otherwise, without the Machzikei HaTorah, you can't have the Talmud Torah at all. So then the Chacham Sofer asks, so then how come before this you have the Aron? So he explains that there are two types of Talmidei Chachamim. There are those who can have enough initiative that they can make that big start even without having anyone support them. And there are those who need a little bit more support. So this order represents that. The idea of Kaftareh, Racham, Yimene, Yiyu, that also these knobs and the flowers, they all have to come from this one piece. The Laharis Nassan suggests that's a reference to the Chidushim in Torah, that they also have to come from within the Torah, so they also have to be of one piece. And the language of Menorah Zav Torah, the Nitziv comments on the way that's phrased, that the Torah is on the menorah, that the etzem of the menorah is the Torah, and the way it's able to burn is a function of the purity of the Jewish people. If they are Torah, so the menorah burns brightly, which really would seem as a reflection of Torah itself, that we know that Torah is only able to speak loudly when the people who learn it are worthy, when it builds on the character of the Jewish people who are studying Torah, otherwise it's Chil Hashem. So that imagery that the Torah is a part of the definition, that is part of what this is conveying. Rav Shamshon Ophel Hirsch, because it has a lot to say about this Aliyah, just to share a little bit about what he says about the menorah, he says that the menorah represents life and God's spirit, and permanence, that's what the gold represents. The form represents rising up to do good. And it's all in one piece because the basic fundamental truths are built upon and expanded, and the seven lamps, he says, there are different viewpoints in diversity, they're all in harmony. The part of the comments that he has on the imagery of all of these different aspects. It's interesting that in Pasuk Lamed Gimel, so the language of the Pasuk is Shlosha Gviyim Meshuchadim B'Kanei Echad Kaftu V'Ferach, Shlosha Gviyim Meshuchadim B'Kanei Echad Kaftu V'Ferach, Kein L'Sheshet Akanim Hayotzim and HaMenorah. So the idea that they should be Meshuchadim, that they could be shaped like almond blossoms, so is that talking about the Gviyim or is that talking about the Kaftar Referah? So that Rashi says, this is one of the few Psukim in Chumash where we really can't tell, that the context doesn't tell us really what we're talking about, and very much Al-Pi Derech HaDrush in the Sefer Paris Yosef, he notes that this represents the imagery here is of different aspects within Torah. And that there are those who are very knowledgeable within Torah, that's what the Gemara calls the Sinai, and there are those who are just very strong in analysis and not as much of a focus on knowledge, we call Okar Harim, and the Gemara has a machlokas as to what's the higher priority. If you have to appoint the head of the academy, so are you going to appoint the Sinai or the Okar Harim? So the Paris Yosef suggests that here the imagery is of these different skills within the menorah, and the question of what is Meshukadim, so again, very much Al-Pi Derech HaDrush, what should you be shoked on, what should you focus on more, that's where there is somewhat of a question and perhaps somewhat of a balance that needs to be drawn. And he suggests there that the answer of what you should be shoked on more is what's not going to lead to an attitude of gaiva. Okay, so there's a lot more to say about this. Again, if you want to look at what Rav Hirsch has to say, you'll read a lot about these psukim. But just to say a few minutes, not to forget Zohar, because that is a crucial obligation to remember. So just to say a little bit about this, we touched upon it briefly during our Aruch HaShulchan Seder in the morning, but just to give a little bit of a sense of what's happening this Shabbos. So we have a mitzvah min HaTorah of Zachar es Asher Asalacha Amalek, as the pasuk is phrased in that reading, which is in the end of Parshas Kisvei. And it's understood from that that we have a mitzvah to remember Amalek. And that is probably connected to the war against Amalek. We have a mitzvah to fight Amalek and a mitzvah to remember Amalek. So we understand, practically speaking, that that requires us to lain this section, and that we do that once a year with a minyan, the Shabbos before Purim. So is all of that min HaTorah? So it's hard to say that all of that is part of the Torah obligation. Clearly, remembering Amalek in some form is a Torah obligation, but how exactly we do it and how often we do it, that there is a lot to figure out. So Gemara says in Megillah that you could have thought that it was just mental. You could just remember it internally. But the language of the pasuk, Zachar al Tishkach, that tells us that you have to also say it out loud. So it's got to be bepeh. Okay, so that much we know from the Gemara. But the idea that it has to be with a minyan is not as obvious. And the idea that it has to be read from a Sefer Torah is not as obvious. There are a few sources in the Rishonim that indicate that way. There is a rush in Maseches Brachos that sounds like he's saying that the need for a minyan to read Parshas Zachar is a mitzvah rabbah, a mitzvah minatorah, what it sounds like. The Trumas Hadeshin, I think we mentioned, has a tshuva where somebody asked him if he's going to go somewhere for Purim where there's a minyan. He normally lives somewhere where there isn't a minyan. He's going to go to a place where there is a minyan for Purim. Should he also go earlier to be there for Shabbos for Parshas Zachar? And the Trumas Hadeshin says, yeah, not only should you do that, but that's more important because Megillah doesn't require a minyan, but Parshas Zachar does. So you do have this idea, in some of the Rishonim at least, that there is this obligation to hear Zachar with a minyan. And the idea that it has to be with a Sefer Torah, some discussion of it have to be a Sefer Torah that's kosher or not. Some point out that maybe the language of the pasuk and Parshas Bishalach of Ksov Zos Zikaron Basefer is a marker for the idea that it should be from a Sefer Torah. And the notion that it has to be specifically B'tzibor, some explain that as connected to the fact that if it's based on the war against Amalek, it's connected to the war against Amalek, so that's not an obligation on the individual. That's an obligation on the tzibor as a whole. So therefore, Zachar should be done together with the tzibor, even though then it becomes a personal obligation that is done with the tzibor. It's not like Kriyas HaTorah in general. So the regular Kriyas HaTorah, which is on a level of Midrabanan, an obligation. So many understood, probably most understood, that regular Kriyas HaTorah is a Chovas HaTzibor. It's an obligation on the community. It's not an obligation on the individual, which was a big discussion this past year. So all of our shuls missed Parshios at the beginning of the pandemic, and the question of making up the Parshios that were missed, that was a whole discussion. But when an individual misses a Parsha, so he's not obligated to make up the laning because it's not his individual mitzvah, it's an obligation on the tzibur. But when it comes to Parsha Zachar, it seems like it's slightly different, that it is a chovas ha-tzibur, it's a chovas ha-yochid done b'tzibur. You need a minyan to do it, but the obligation is on the individual to hear Parsha Zachar. So where do you get the idea that it has to be once a year? Okay, so if we understand that you have to hear it from the Sefer Torah with a minyan, but how do you know that it has to be once a year? So the Chassam Sofer is credited with the Chiddush that if the Torah tells us not to forget, we should remember not to forget, that there's a certain period of time after which you start to forget. And if the Torah says you have to make sure you don't forget something. It means to remind yourself within a certain period of time. And he understands that period of time is 12 months. Asher Shikha is Yud Beis Chodesh, based on two Gemaras. One is the Gemara in Brachos that says, Ein Hameis Mishtakech Min Alev Ela Acher Yud Beis Chodesh, that when somebody passes away, people don't begin to forget him until after 12 months. And also the Gemara in the second Parak above Messiah that says that Stam Yeish, that you can expect that a person gave up hope of getting back their lost property after 12 months. So apparently 12 months is when people start to forget. So therefore, if the Torah says don't forget, you have to remind yourself every 12 months. So every year, you have to have a booster shot, basically, of Zichira Samalik. So that prompted the question that the Maram Shik and others discussed. So what happens if there's a leap year? That adds a complication, because there you have that extra other, just when you don't want it, you have an extra month coming in between your two Zichiros. So is that a problem? So there were some who recommended that in such a situation, you should have Kavanah in the summertime when they read Parshas Kisetze in the regular cycle to be Yotze Zohar then, because otherwise it's going to be too long. It's going to be 12 months in between. And others disagreed with that for various reasons. Pointed out that even without a leap year, you could have a few days off. You could have that you're not going to get exactly 12 months, depending on when the calendar falls out. It could be 12 months and 3 days since the last Parsha Zohar. So if we're really going to be so precise about it, we're going to have problems in years that aren't leap years too. So presumably, when the Chasam Sofer said, Shir Shukha is 12 months, he didn't mean exactly 12 months. He meant the cycle of the year, that once you hit the next year, the same point the next year, now, unfortunately, we're remembering the anniversary of the beginning of the pandemic was a year ago this week, so we're all thinking, okay, where were we last year? We remember now where we were last Purim. When you hit the same event in the calendar the next year, so it brings up everything from the past year, and then it kind of restarts. So the idea of saying 12 months doesn't mean literally 12 months. It means that that's the cycle of the year, and then you need to have a refresher after you pass that milestone. So a leap year, according to that understanding, wouldn't be a problem, and a calendaric year being a little bit more than a week wouldn't be a problem. It's all about the cycle. But the others question the whole idea of the Shir Shikha to begin with. Now, the Satmar Rav has a tshuva about this, where he says he doesn't understand the proofs. He says the idea of Ames Mishtakech Menalev, that means that when a person died and the people are trying to get past it, they're trying to move on, after a year, they start to succeed. It doesn't mean that if you had a mitzvah to remember something, that you would forget it after a year. And the idea of Stam Yeish after 12 months, so that doesn't mean you forgot about your object. It means that you haven't got your object returned after 12 months, so you start to give up hope that it's ever going to happen. But that doesn't mean that you forgot about it. So you didn't think that the whole idea of Yud Beis Chodesh as a Shir Shikha is necessarily compelling. But presumably the idea that we do it at this time is to connect to Purim, because we understand that the war against Haman is an extension of the war against Amalek. Haman is a descendant of Amalek. So therefore, Chazal ordained that the mitzvah min HaTorah of Zechira would be done in association with Purim. But it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the only way that it can be done, and that it's necessarily connected to that on a level min HaTorah. So this is especially relevant because this year as well, so this year especially, it could be that people are in quarantine, it could be people aren't able to go to shul for whatever reason. So what to do about Zohar? So there are a number of etzes, and what I would recommend to people is do as many of them as possible, and probably at least one of them is going to address the situation. You'll cover your bases through all of the etzes. So first of all, if you are able to go to shul on Purim, so it was a machlokas, whether it had to be specifically the reading from Kisetze, or it could be the attack of Amalek, which is in the end of Parshas Bishalach. That's what we read on Purim, so it could be the Kriyas HaTorah on Purim, could also count as the fulfillment of Zechiras Amalek. And if not that, then it could be that you could be Yotze with Parshas Kisetze, if the timing is right, and if you're able to be in shul then, or if b'shalach does count, if you were in shul for b'shalach in its normal cycle, then that may also count as well. It could also be that if somebody is unable to be in shul, so if he opens up a chumash and learns the psukim of Zachar the Shabbos, so he won't fulfill all of the possible positions, but at least he'll have the Zechira Samalik on some level happening the same Shabbos when everyone else is doing it. So if you do all these things, and some suggest also having a reading during the week, which some shuls are doing in order to create an extra option, which presumably should also be effective. So all those options together, or many of them as possible, that should probably go pretty far as fulfilling this obligation of Zecheres Lamalik. It's a question whether women are obligated to say for Achinuch, but women are not obligated. It's not clear why that should matter, because why that should be the position, because it's not a mitzvah sasesha as man grama, so the Achronim all struggle to understand why women should be Peturos. It would sound like women should be Chayavos. So some suggest that it's based on the idea of Mohammed Samalik being the theme here. This is about the war on Amalek. And therefore, it's something that doesn't apply to women, because the Gemara in the beginning of Kiddushin says that Ein Darka Shalisha, the woman's method is not to go out to Mochama. However, others point out that the Mishnah says in Sota, Mochama's mitzvah, afilu kala mechupata, and the Malik is Mochama's mitzvah. So it's a little bit of a back and forth how exactly to understand that issue, and many posts can feel that women are obligated in Parsha Zachar. That was Machlokes. But it's also a part of their considerations when it's complicated like this year. So how exactly to address that and how to make enough opportunities available. Most of the women are Machmir to hear Parsha Zachar. But that itself was a part of a big Machlokes. So there's a lot to say about the importance of Zecheres Amalek and what the message is. On one level, Amalek represents absolute evil, and it sounds like from the way they're described in the Torah that they represent the terrorists, that they attack the weak and they come from behind and they don't follow the laws of war. So the idea that God declares that he cannot coexist essentially with Amalek, that his kisei will not be complete as long as Amalek is still around, we have to always fight them. So it seems like part of the message is that the whole terrorist approach of not being civilized in any way and not being committed to even rules within war and to attack the innocent and to attack the weak, that's something which is so incompatible with life in this world that it has to be eradicated fully. But it's also interesting that there's an additional symbolism that Chazal find in Amalek. They say based on the Pasuk in Mishlei, let takei ufes diyarim, that Chazal understand that the let that's referred to is Amalek. So thinking of Amalek as a let, as a clown, that sounds very strange. How do you see let as a clown figure? It's not the kind of imagery you would have if you're imagining the Amalek that's described in the Torah. So Rav Huttner has a very important essay about this, highly recommended reading over the next week as you anticipate Purim. That's the first Maimer in the Pachad Yitzchak on Purim. So Rav Huttner explains that the idea of Leitzonus, the way it's used in Tanakh and elsewhere, is that Leitzonus doesn't mean joking around, being a clown. Leitzonus means cynicism. That it means the attitude of thinking that nothing is important. And that's a highly destructive attitude, because somebody who believes that nothing is important, so it doesn't matter how valuable the message is, it's never going to get across if you're able to just knock down everything and to take away its significance. So you are going to be immune to any kind of growth. And it is a very harmful mindset. And as Bali Musser say, that the slightest dose of cynicism of that kind of leitzonus makes it impossible for any Musser to get through. So what does that have to do with Amalek? How does Amalek represent the cynic? So we know that Chazal say that the Jews were considered formidable after Matan Torah and after Kriyas Yamsuf. So the whole world was scared of them, and they were like a boiling bath that everyone was afraid to jump into. And Amalek said, we're not afraid, we'll jump in, we'll attack, we'll show you that they're not so formidable, they're not so scary. So that's essentially the act of a cynic saying, you think this is important, I'll show you it's not so important, I'll show you it's not so meaningful. And if that's the case, so then we have to work very hard to eradicate that attitude as well. And one could suggest that that's also a part of the message of having Parshas Zachar right before Purim, because Purim is in a time of the calendar, time of the Jewish year, where we focus on a lighter attitude, where we have found humor and laughter integrated as part of the day. Why is that the case? That's a fascinating question of itself. Maybe we'll have some opportunities to talk about that between now and Purim and address that a little bit more. But in anticipation of that, you could just say that if we are going to focus on a sense of humor, so we still have to be very careful that it's not a cynical sense of humor, because cynicism is so highly destructive that will undermine anything positive that can come from our sense of humor. So all the more so, before we come to Purim, we have to have this reminder of the dangers of cynicism. And that's what Parshas Zachar also does for us as we anticipate Purim. And this, as we alluded to before, goes well with the idea of the Chasam Sofer in last week's Parsha that we mentioned about the way Talmid Chachamim relate to each other, seeking the truth. And the truth cannot be found in an atmosphere of cynicism. And we mentioned also before the Rosh Yeshiva of Goldach's approach that when the Mishnah says that Shnayim Shiyashvu V'Ein B'Neim Divrei Torah, so that means that there's a cynical attitude between them, that they don't respect each other, so there's Divrei Torah not between them. And that's why the Mishnah calls it a Moshe of Leitzim, that is a session of scoffers, that are people who are disrespectful towards each other, who have an attitude that there's no importance in the other person. And that is very dangerous. So as we approach Purim, which is also a time of Kabbalah Satara, and we have that on our minds, that's something to think about very carefully, about our need to remember the dangers of cynicism and the dangers of any kind of a mindset that's not going to allow for anything good to flourish. And that's a big part of what Amalek represents and what we're trying to fortify ourselves against this Shabbos. So I will wish you a memorable Shabbos in all positive ways. I will see you, God willing, on Sunday during our normal times. I should also mention that I'm supposed to speak at the Kol Yom Rishon Sunday morning also, speak probably about themes of Purim and Torah Shavuot. So if anybody wants to drop in then on Zoom, you're invited to that as well. That'll be in between our morning check-in and the regular share time, so you're invited if you like. And until then, I wish you a wonderful, memorable Shabbos. You should stay warm, stay safe, stay safe, stay healthy, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you.
Great job.